similarly limited first-hand descriptions of dissections on stranded whales from this era, though they must have been uniquely awful. Once word of a whale stranding arrived at the door of a rural doctor or an amateur naturalist in the 18th or 19th century, the opportunity would have launched a whirlwind of ad hoc planning for several days of dreary, odorous dissection. The happenstance of a whale stranding dictated where the dissection occurred. The scale of the carcass would have dwarfed the tools at hand, the decay of flesh accelerated by nice weather or retarded by wet and cold conditions. The work was certainly not glamorous. There were no modern winches or cranes, nor photographs to document the findings. Just ink, paper, and a strong stomach. A stranded whale affords a detailed look not merely at diagnostic traits. A ridge along the snout, a piebald underbelly, or a knuckled tailstock, but at its inner anatomy, musculature, and organ systems, which can't be described from a boat. In the early 19th century, the first naturalists to roll up their sleeves and describe what they saw were enabled by an emerging infrastructure for scientific reporting, published scientific proceedings. By writing down, illustrating, and sharing what they saw, they created the basis for others to seek out their own comparisons. Even Aristotle knew that whales were mammals, but these first detailed dissections revealed facts of their inner world that were equally familiar and puzzling. They had a heart, lungs, a stomach, an intestine, and a reproductive tract, just like a dairy cow or a tax collector. The early scholarship generated by careful anatomical work on whale strandings had serious impact on science, surpassed only by anatomists working under more stable laboratory conditions, with the benefit of refrigeration and power tools generations later. While today we know that, for instance, blue whales off Ireland, California, and South Africa all belong to a single species, naturalists in the 18th and 19th centuries did not. With incomplete, and sometimes incorrect, descriptions of other large whales, naturalists puzzled by variations in color or size would sometimes create a new scientific name based on a single stranding, or judge that a whale's appearance, far from another record, merited its description as a new species. It took until the early 20th century for Frederick William True, one of my predecessors at the Smithsonian, to unravel these issues for large baleen whales and demonstrate that blue whales, humpbacks, and fin whales, among several others, were the same species on both sides of the Atlantic, despite dozens of taxonomic names purporting otherwise. True spent years working with original name-bearing specimens, called type specimens, for these different species, doing what taxonomists largely regard as housecleaning, a time-consuming task involving chasing specimens that are archived around the world's museums and figuring out their identity. Even today, there are some species of beaked whales known only from skulls washed up on a beach. Yes, in the 21st century, there are several ton-heavy species of mammals in our planet's oceans whose scientific basis primarily relies on a single beach-cast skull. Beaked whales are among the deepest diving whales, looking something like a bottlenose dolphin crossed with a submarine. In fact, we know very little about most species of beaked whales, which account for nearly a quarter of all whale species alive today. They simply live too far at sea, dive too deep, and are incredibly difficult to tag or photograph in life. Without museums to house the rare remains that do turn up, we would know far less about these enigmatic species. Not every whale that dies washes ashore, of course. Whalers for several hundred years have known that some whales float after death, while others sink. Dead sperm whales float because of the enormous oil chambers housed above their faces, as Yankee whalers knew well. Right whales earned their moniker because they were the right whales to hunt, and they float after death because of their massive blubber layer, a trait they share with bowhead whales, their close relatives of the Arctic. Other large baleen whales, such as blue or humpback whales, will sink after a prolonged time at the surface, although carcasses can refloat following enough decay, when the gases from decomposition make the carcass buoyant. It isn't uncommon to see the large throat pouch of some of these whales balloon after death, like an emergency airbag that somehow failed to deploy properly in life. Beyond these facts, known mostly to whalers and beachcombers, no one really knew much more until 1977, when a U.S. Navy submarine cruiser accidentally discovered a gray whale carcass on a seafloor more than 4,000 feet deep, west of Catalina Island, off the California coast. Of course, we already knew that some whale carcasses fall through the water column and reach the ocean floor, well beyond the depth that light penetrates. It's just that no one had ever seen the result until then. The scientists who later worked up the growing number of these discoveries called them whale falls. At thousands of feet deep, the seafloor is not merely cold and bathed in black. Its surface is mostly barren, until a carcass lands, ending its transit through the water column, an elision between two worlds that began with the whale's last breath at the surface. Whatever flesh that has not already been picked away by sharks or pecked by seabirds provides immediate food for scavengers, such as deep sea sharks, fishes, and crabs. How exactly they find a fallen whale remains a mystery. In very little time, researchers estimate weeks to months, these creatures will strip the carcass of its flesh, leaving only bone. On the deep seafloor, there's little current to disturb the position of the bones, leaving the skeleton looking mostly how it looked as it fell through the water column. The jaws close to or in direct articulation with the skull, which itself is connected to the vertebral column, in a straight line, with arm and flipper bones off to each side, assuming these parts weren't ripped off by scavengers at the water's surface. But once seafloor scavengers swim and scurry away, the story isn't over. Scientists aboard deep-sea submersibles have set out in search of whale fall skeletons and even experimentally sunk whale carcasses to predetermine locations to learn more. With enough replications and time, they found that whale falls undergo successive phases, not unlike a forest ecosystem that changes in composition and size as it matures over decades. Once defleshed, whale falls undergo a second phase of colonization by snails, clams, and polychaete worms, some feeding off cartilage and the surfaces of the bone, others burrowing into the apron of sediment around the skeleton, enriched by the organic material leaching off the whale's blubber and oil. The snails, clams, and polychaetes take months to a few years to consume all that they can, and afterward a third phase begins, which can last decades or more. No one knows because whale falls have been studied for only 40 years. This presumably final climax stage involves two sets of bacteria living in or on whale bones, anaerobic bacteria that use sulfate in the seawater to digest oil locked in the whale's bones, and then sulfur-loving bacteria that use the sulfide byproduct of the anaerobic bacteria to generate energy by combining it with dissolved oxygen. Sulfophilic bacteria support a variety of true whale fall specialists at this stage, including some mussels, clams, and tube worms that have the bacteria living symbiotically within them, giving them the opportunity to generate their own energy in a world devoid of sunlight. At these depths, whale carcasses give a second life to an otherwise barren, abyssal world. While the precise duration of these skeletons on the seafloor remains unknown, the upper bounds of some estimates suggest that a single whale carcass can provide up to 100 years of sustenance. So little is known about the breadth and variation in whale falls that new discoveries are being made all the time. One is an organism called Ozodax, literally Latin for bone-devouring, a species of deep-sea worm whose entire life cycle depends on whale fall skeletons. Appearing as pinkish filaments only a few millimeters long, covering the surfaces of bone, Ozodax does not have a mouth or a gut, just wavy tendrils called pulps facing outward. Instead of harboring symbiotic bacteria that use a sulfur-based pathway for decomposing bone lipids, its symbionts are a type of bacteria that mobilize proteins directly from the bone itself by dissolving it, using a tangled mat of bacteria-filled roots burrowed into the bones. Not all whale fall colonizers are specialists. Some are generalists that also make appearances on hot vents and methane cold seeps deep on the ocean floor. the range of the temperatures and environmental settings across these deep sea habitats has led some scientists to argue that whale falls over millions of years have served as evolutionary stepping stones for invertebrates living in one habitat to leap to another. This idea remains hotly debated, with little known about all of the species that feast on fallen whales, or how often and where these skeletons are likely to appear on the sea floor. A whale's size would seem to play an important role for a unique ecosystem that is fundamentally tied to its carcass. After all, a larger dead body should provide more opportunities for whale fall specialists. It turns out that size doesn't make too much of a difference where whale falls are concerned, and the reason why we know has to do with the fossil record. As a graduate student, I had the good fortune to come across a fossil whale skull that had been collected a few decades prior from rocks exposed on Año Nuevo Island off the coast of Central California. These rocks represent extremely deep sea sediments, about 15 million to 11 million years old. And I didn't think much about the fossil's context until I was cleaning the skull in the fossil preparation lab at Berkeley's Paleontology Museum and came across tiny clamshells nestled in crevices of the skull. They clustered together, almost lifelike, and I decided to pry one off for a closer look after first documenting their arrangement. A mollusk specialist confirmed a possibility that had entered my mind. They were chemosymbiotic clams belonging to a family that specialized in whale falls. In short, the fossil I'd been preparing belonged to a fossil whale fall. Fossil whales with whale fall mollusks affixed to them had been found before. And while unusual, they weren't earth-shaking discoveries on their own. But what was different was that this skull belonged to a whale that would have been barely 11 feet long in life. Tiny baleen whales, much smaller than those today, were common during the Miocene. But the remarkable aspect of this find was that their body size did not prevent the whale fall from reaching the peak phase of sulfur-loving invertebrates. In other words, size doesn't really determine the community that colonizes a whale fall ecosystem. If not, then what does? That's still not clear, although it may be something about the lipids locked in the bones that control which species can colonize the carcass, along with the stages of whale fall succession. If you've ever seen a fossil on display in a museum, you might wonder why it is that animals sometimes preserve nearly intact, while others leave only a single bone. Understanding how the dead enter the fossil record is a field of study unto itself, known as taphonomy. And it focuses on the entire pathway that filters the information we can know about an organism, from death to discovery. Taphonomy is really the study of information loss in anatomy and ecology. Ideally, we want the whole picture of the ancient worlds that we study, but we don't ever truly get that because of the vicissitudes of how living things fall apart after death. Taphonomy has old world origins, having been independently developed by Russian and German scientists working in isolation for the first half of the 20th century. It wasn't until translations of their work trickled into the hands of American paleontologists decades later that the idea of using the biological present to understand death, destruction, and preservation in the past became a mature scientific field worthy of a name. One of taphonomy's pioneers was Wilhelm Schaefer, a German who spent decades observing the patterns of death and decay along the shores of the North Sea. While Schaefer patiently gave every sea creature that appeared as flotsam the same kind of attention he reserved for stranded whales, he nonetheless led off his seminal treatise on taphonomy with a decaying porpoise. Exacting and precise, he recognized the value of watching decay and decomposition patterns in large organisms, showing, for example, how a jaw peels off from a skull before the skull unlocks from the rest of the carcass. Whales are put together just like most backboned animals, and true to form, their lower jaws sometimes scatter far from the original carcass. This kind of observation is exactly the kind of clue that helps someone like me imagine how dead whales end up arranged as fossils, and how those fossils looked when they were whales. Stranded whales always seemed to me like a fruitful place to start But it took me some time to realize that you needed to think at the scale of oceans to understand what was important about them. In graduate school, a colleague of mine pointed out to me that nearly every species of whale that lived along the California coast had, at one time or another, washed ashore along a single 10-mile strip of coastline at Point Reyes National Seashore. When I went to dig deeper into his assertion, I found records kept by marine mammal stranding networks, coordinated by government agencies with federal oversight, which compiled whale stranding statistics for the entire west coast of the United States, among other regions. Species identification, length, sex, condition, all data that were logged in the spreadsheets, provided an inventory of which whales, and how many, were stranded across nearly 1,300 miles of coastline. Interestingly, whale biologists working for the same government agencies had performed detailed survey transects tabulating whale species from boats, which led me to wonder how well these two kinds of observations, one from the dead, the other from the living, matched up. The answer? Surprisingly well. The dead and living data sets mirrored each other in terms of the number of whale species and their relative abundance. That is to say, the high proportions of individuals in some species over others. For a variety of reasons, there are a lot more bottlenose dolphins and blue whales out along the coast. In fact, over the course of decades, the stranding record recovered more species of whales than any living survey, including both common and rare species. In some cases, strandings picked up species that had never been seen in any boat-based survey. In other words, real ecological data are recorded by whale strandings, so long as you look at the right scales of time and space. All of these thoughts spun in my mind as I walked through the rows of whale skeletons by the side of the highway at Cerro Baena. I could imagine the site representing some kind of stranding. In the same breath, however, I also wondered if it was too tempting a label to apply, given that we didn't have any hard data in hand, nor any putative cause for why a stranding would have occurred here. Strandings are rare in the fossil record. In the published literature, there's perhaps one possible mass stranding implied by piles of fossil ambergris, a hardened mass composed of squid beaks, preserved closely together, and another implied by three sperm whale skulls found together in a sand berm. Neither of these compared with the scale of what Cerro Baena seemed to represent. Moreover, shorelines tend to be energetic environments where waves would disperse and destroy stranded carcasses. By contrast, many of the fossil skeletons at Cerro Baena seemed undisturbed, hardly ravaged by the elements or by scavengers. From a brief walkabout at the site, I thought that Cerro Baena had many outward signs of something like a mass stranding, especially in terms of the completeness and density of whale skeletons. How we could know and sort out any possible explanation remained a question very much at the top of my list. We were going to need data, lots of them. Chapter 6, Rock Picks and Lasers. In nearly 20 years of digging whales on every continent, the number of times I had ever found a complete skeleton of a fossil whale was exactly zero. It's not to say that it doesn't happen for other people, but it certainly isn't routine. The rarity of a single, complete fossil whale skeleton is a major aspect of why Cerro Baena was so confounding. Any one of its beautifully preserved skeletons would have been a discovery worthy of celebrating and agonizing over its salvage. Dozens of them yards apart demanded some kind of explanation and a plan. Up until I realized the full scope of Cerro Baena, my fieldwork in Chile had consisted of several years of low-risk science focusing on paleontological essentials, measuring the thickness of fossil-bearing rock sequences at different places throughout the heavily fragmented caldera basin, and connecting these blocks by linking rock units of similar type and appearance. The end goal was understanding how the Humboldt Current was different in the past. Playing it safe was a sure bet for delivering results, as a matter of science politics. Our grant funders would demand results from our expedition. Making good on the stated mission mattered to the team, especially to me as principal investigator, the lead scientist on the grant. Successful delivery meant many publications, ideally in the best journals. As someone just starting his career at a major institution, I felt added pressure to deliver. To my mind, that meant sticking to the plan and tying together a coherent story, not getting mired in too big of a side project with uncertain rewards. But I couldn't unsee Sarabayana, nor did I want to. It glowed with significance. It was the kind of unparalleled site that could boost the career of everyone associated with it, should it be successfully reported. Whatever explained the density and completeness of the skeletons was also surely an interesting scientific story, especially for understanding the evolution of whales in ocean ecosystems. But we needed to somehow wrap our minds around essential facts about the site before we could make any conclusions about how Sarabayana came to be or what it could tell us. It seemed obvious that the sheer abundance of big whales at the site, clearly belonging to a species of extinct rorqual, was an important part of the puzzle. Getting more facts about those whales, however, would be daunting. A single whale skeleton might contain as many as 200 bones, some as heavy as bowling balls or cumbersome as fallen tree limbs, topped off by a skull the size of a grand piano. Collecting a single whale skeleton, even one less complete than those at Sarabayana, requires coordinated effort by more than one person, usually over several days. First, you begin with what bone is available on the surface and get on your hands and knees to inspect it. If it's not too fragile, there's no harm in carefully exposing it a bit more by brushstroke until you know what's there. Generally, we try to save the time-consuming, detail-oriented work for the lab, but the bones can't get there unless they're exhumed from the ground. That means trenching a judicious perimeter around them and then wrapping them in plaster bandages that dry and form a hard cocoon. This protective shell allows us to securely pop the block containing the fossil out of the ground and bring it back to the lab for more work. Straightforward, but time-consuming when you're dealing with skeletal elements the size of furniture pieces. When bones are scattered loosely all over the place, as is often the case, then the excavation becomes more like a crime scene involving a grid, usually string hooked over nails or rebar, overlying the area to map out the position of each bone. The grid makes the relationships among all the bones clear and allows us to plot their locations on a sheet of paper. Then, after plotting, each bone is cataloged and removed individually, or sometimes collectively in small jackets, like the larger blocks. It's painstaking work. In the case of Sarabayana, the costs of removing each fossil whale were the responsibility of the road construction company. The company had agreed to pay Tuareg and his museum volunteers to expose, map, and document each skeleton to the best of their abilities before jacketing the skeletons, sometimes whole or in pieces as plaster jackets the size of tables and mid-sized cars. At the largest sizes, plaster bandages and burlap would have failed, so metal support structures had to be added to ensure that the inner fossils were safely transported. While these steps saved the fossils themselves, we were losing crucial information every time a skeleton was pulled from the ground. Separating the bones from the context, how they were buried, their orientation, their association with other bones, and so forth, that we would need to answer pressing questions about the origin of the site. The most pressing consideration of all? Tuareg said we had probably less than a month to study the site before all the fossils needed to be removed to make way for the highway's northbound lane. It was a stunning constraint. With the specter of the skeletons at Sarabayana hanging over all of us, we measured and sampled all the rock sections that we had originally sought. The next steps, in terms of assembling a single chronology of rocks in the Caldera Basin, would have to be largely lab or museum-based. We had run out of time to do anything more. I knew we needed to act on Sarabayana. I just didn't know how. We barely had enough time to snap a few photos and measure the rocks at the site. Nothing conclusive. It loomed in my mind, a whale-sized, multifaceted question that felt personal. What was I going to do about it? On the return flight to the United States with Jim and Caro, I tried not to dwell on the logistics and instead thought about the bigger scientific questions. Was it a stranding, a one-time catastrophic event, an accumulation of bodies slowly over time? Testing any possible explanation for how all these whale skeletons had arrived at the site would require an evaluation, bone by bone, skeleton by skeleton, to determine overall condition, arrangement, the articulation of each bone relative to the others, whether they had been scavenged, and so on. This type of forensic study would take time, definitely more than we had. I wasn't sure which data were the most important to obtain fastest. The sheer magnitude of the task was overwhelming. As I watched Jim ease into a window seat with his laptop for the long flight back to the United States from Santiago, I had an idea. If there was some way we could capture the bones digitally, beyond just static images, we might be able to buy time away from the site, back in the lab. I suddenly remembered a recent chance meeting with two people who did exactly that kind of thing. I first encountered Adam Metallo and Vince Rossi in a windowless photography room in a research wing of the Smithsonian, hunched over the enormous skull of an extinct crocodile relative. They were passing a laser beam over its bony surface, using a robotic arm connected to a laptop. Vince straightened to introduce himself, smoothed invisible creases in his untucked shirt, and launched into a demonstration. As he talked, I watched Adam paint light over the croc skull. The data then appeared in real time as a patchwork of surfaces stitched into a 3D model on the computer screen. Adam and Vince were part of a then-nascent 3D digitization program at the Smithsonian, and they were looking for partners at museums throughout the Smithsonian constellation to provide case studies for their work. I thought what they were doing was genuinely interesting, but at the time I wondered what scientific problem scanning was solving. I thought it was more important to have a question first and let the technology serve that aim. By the time I was 30,000 feet over South America, poking my airplane food portion of palate-blistering ravioli, I realized that I'd found that question. Back at the museum, I did my best to present my quandary to Adam and Vince, convey my excitement, and hope for some kind of fruitful collaboration. In contrast with the traditional field methods in paleontology, it seemed obvious that laser scanning would have incredible advantages at Cerro Baena. First and most crucially, it was many times faster than the time-consuming and costly steps of drawing grid maps or making large plaster molds with latex. Scanning would also have no physical contact with the fossil, eliminating any risk of damaging the bones when pulling off a latex peel. Second, scanning would create a digital model that was essentially a snapshot in time. There would be no decay of the facsimile, the way a latex peel or even a plastic cast slowly degrades over time. Given the scale of a single fossil whale skeleton, capturing a digital copy seemed like an ideal way to make comparisons across the potentially dozens of skeletons at Cerro Baena. Far easier to overlay or make side-by-side comparisons on a computer screen than pacing from skeleton to skeleton in the real world. Laser scanning also surpassed the practicalities of other technological solutions. X-rays might perform similarly well, but there was no good way to bring an instrument that produced X-rays, such as a CT scanner, out to field localities. Nor was there any way to fit a 30-foot whale skeleton in a standard hospital CT scanner. Only a few CT scanners in the world can handle objects approaching a few feet in the largest dimension. X-rays would have circumvented line-of-sight issues inherent for very large objects. The small overhangs and deep pockets along the vertebrae and skull pose the same challenges to a laser and camera as they do to a paintbrush full of silicone, because these nooks and crannies can't always be perfectly captured below the threshold of your application tool. As it turned out, Cerro Baena would be the first of many successful collaborative projects in the realm of 3D digitizing of museum specimens. Adam, Vince, and I became fast friends. I immediately took a shine to their background in exhibit arts. artists and scientists aren't so different when you consider how creative enterprises see the light of day only when they squeeze past all the barriers of resources, personality, and time. Adam and Vince also knew that there were as many narratives as there were specimens in the Smithsonian's holdings, and that 3D had the promise to make those stories accessible and visible. Once I secured Adam and Vince's interest in my particular case, Caro and I went about securing funding for a last-minute field season with food, gas, trucks, lodging, and equipment, and airfare for now nearly a dozen people. We made a great team when it came to carefully calibrated funding pitches to the director's office at the museum and to National Geographic, which funded part of our original season of fieldwork. As we flexed charm and rhetoric to underscore the urgency of the project, we managed to cobble together enough funds to cover the immediate costs of a return to Chile. In the flurry of activity, it became more and more clear that tackling Cerro Baena meant moving out of a safe zone into the high-risk, high-reward category of scientific endeavors. For me, a pre-tenure curator, it was an unnerving consideration. Scientists earn credibility by finishing big projects and delivering results. Spending a lot of time and money with nothing to show for it, especially on an international stage, means risking your future, and those of your early career colleagues too. I didn't want to expose Caro, Tuareg, and Jim to those kinds of risks any more than myself. When we returned to Chile, Tuareg was there to greet us. I introduced him to Vince and Adam, saving other concerns for later. We made directly for Cerro Baena, along the Pan-American Highway, arriving less than an hour after our plane had landed near Caldera in Copiapó. With a week to go before Tuareg's deadline, we didn't have time for diversions. We needed laser-like focus. Tuareg and his team had already made strategic decisions about which whale skeletons to document and remove and which ones to leave intact before we could arrive. Less than a dozen, I guessed, from a quick survey. In the brief interim, while we were gone, I knew Tuareg had done the best he could to preserve what was at hand, as the road construction company quickly scraped away the overlying rocks, down to the level of the highway. As an outsider, I had limited sway in Chilean politics. I wasn't sure what to expect until we rolled up to the quarries, which had been overlain by sediment only weeks before, and now opened into a space about the size of two football fields end to end. We had two basic approaches at our disposal, with very different logistics. A laser arm scanner, which required elaborate setup, especially with a heavy, shake-proof base to keep its position static during scanning, that collected the geometry of surfaces at sub-millimeter precision, and handheld high-end digital cameras, which would collect images to build a 3D model with software back in the United States. The laser arm scanner and its attendant gear were too cumbersome to move whale to whale and would need to be dedicated to a single skeleton. Camera work, on the other hand, could be deployed across multiple skeletons. One array of three skeletons piled on top of one another was clearly a high priority for photography, an aggregation people at the site had taken to calling La Familia. The two bigger adult-sized skeletons lay tail to nose, splayed in a V, but complete in every way, including even hip bones. Joining them, in a small leg across the opening of the V, was a smaller skeleton belonging to a juvenile whale with unfused skull bones. I'm generally loath to use nicknames as a shorthand for individual specimens, mainly because I think that pet names trivialize the hard work that goes into collecting and studying fossils. At Cerro Baena, we used Tuareg's field numbers across the site, but La Familia was a lot more convenient than saying B21, B22, and B23. I also had to admit that La Familia conveyed some awe for the oblong, heart-shaped outline of the trio of fossil whales. There was no guidebook for the work that we set out to do, and it required a lot of thought, creativity, and trust. We camped out only yards away from the highway, and every 18-wheeler screaming downhill reminded us of that impending northbound lane. Tuareg and his team constructed a tent over B-33, one of the most perfectly preserved of all the large baleen whales at the site, to shield the equipment and work from the dust and wind. We improvised seating on the largest transport cases, which also doubled as workbenches. Vince and Adam got priority with the only card table, which they used to create a workstation for their souped-up laptops. At one point, I paused at the back of one of the field trucks and watched Adam and Vince busy at work with laptops, laser scanners, and tripods, while cables and accessories spilled out around them. "You guys are like some kind of laser cowboys," I said, smiling. Adam grinned in reply, and Vince laughed, but they both kept at work. The sound of all the busy work at Cerro Baena gave me confidence, for the first time, that we might actually pull off this ambitious plan of turning the physical into the digital. Days and nights melted away in the tent as the cowboys slowly moved from nose to tail, scanning B-33. Each pass of the laser arm, like a thick brush stroke, was instantaneously transmitted to the laptop, revealing more and more of the skeleton's digital avatar on the screen before us. The fine resolution of the entire scan, highlighted in raking light by the computer program, looked like a bas-relief from antiquity. Nothing like it existed, as far as I knew. No fossil skeleton had been scanned in the ground with this kind of detail, and certainly not a fossil whale. I smiled for a moment, thinking how fantastic it was that we could capture and bottle the context of a skeleton like this one. There might be dissertations worth of study in the dataset from B-33 alone. And we had also collected the photography data from all of the other whales, including La Familia. Later, back at the Smithsonian, the cowboys would take these colossal, dense clouds of scanned data points and photographs and translate them into 3D models of the whales at Cerro Baena in incredible detail. The sub-millimeter precision of B-33 and the slightly coarser millimeter scale precision of La Familia was a way to future-proof the 3D models. We collected information at the highest possible resolution and preserved each rendering at every step of the process. The basic underlying data were also recoverable well into the future by using standard formats for the digital photos and simple text files for X, Y, and Z coordinates of the scanned data. These measures ensured that the time frame for studying the digital facsimiles of Cerro Baena would extend for years to come. The 3D data from Cerro Baena were mesmerizing to behold on a computer screen, far from the field site. But it's a whole other experience to 3D print them, especially at the scale where they fit in your hand. Even today, when I pick up a color 3D print of them, skeletons that took walking strides to appreciate and comprehend, now rendered compact in my hands, I'm transported back to our days at the site, even to the specific time of day, based on the shadows printed in relief. Even more exciting was the opportunity to 3D print one of the Cerro Baena skeletons at large scale, which today anyone can see at the Smithsonian, inside the Natural History Museum's Learning Center auditorium. Thousands of miles away and years removed from our work, I can walk the length of a plastic copy of B-33 on a wall, seamlessly stitched together from individual tiles. I can tilt my head to just the right angle to see the skeleton, tinted with some paint, as it would have lain on the ground, and remember our long days beside the highway in the Atacama. These facsimiles tell stories as much as the real thing. More important, they can be shared with anyone who has access to email, a computer screen, or a 3D printer. At the site, as Adam and Vince worked away at scanning, I shifted my focus toward the geological and paleontological data that we would need to test any idea about how this graveyard at Cerro Baena came to be. During our first field season, as part of our larger work in the Caldera Basin, we measured the stack of rocks exposed at the site. The stratigraphic column created from this work presents a kind of key that can be used to determine the geologic age of the rocks. The column also provides a basis for interpreting the kind of environments that those rocks represented, the overall setting, when the whales were first deposited at Cerro Baena. By the second field season, we had realized something profound about the site. Cerro Baena wasn't just one layer of whale skeletons, but four, all directly on top of one another. It took us some time to come around to this conclusion, in large part because the Pan American Highway cuts a long diagonal gash across the horizontal units of the site as the road dips to the south. As a consequence of the length of this slope, we never had one complete view of all the layers at the site. From the tent over B-33, we could see other whale skeletons to the north that appeared to be higher in the rock section by several feet. But we didn't know if that was a real feature or the result of the widespread faulting throughout the basin, which might have broken up a single layer into a vertical jumble like uneven blocks of a sidewalk. A full reading of the layers at Cerro Baena came only from walking back and forth along the slope, moving up and down in geologic time, and tracing out individual layers from skeleton to skeleton alongside the rock wall. This hands-on process let us track the horizontal positions of individual whale skeletons as we went, giving us visceral proof that there were indeed multiple layers of skeletons on top of one another. B-33 was in the second layer out of four. Directly adjacent to B-33, profiled on the new road-cut wall, we could touch still more whale skeletons, unexposed, which were directly on top of it in the rock sequence. We also quickly realized that we needed Tuareg to help us reconstruct the placement of each whale skeleton in this new context. We were missing which whale came from what layer for everything collected before that insight. For all of his showmanship, Tuareg never failed us as a paleontologist, and we were able to deduce the information from his detailed notes and quarry diagrams. The fact that Cerro Baena was actually four sites piled directly on top of one another was a stunning revelation for the scientists on our team. It was a piece of the puzzle hiding in plain sight, as important as the completeness or close proximity of each skeleton. Multiple whale-bearing rock layers at the site meant that there might be some unifying cause for why they were deposited in this one particular place. A basic proposition in science in that repeated patterns tend to be generated by the same underlying process. Chapter 7, Cracking the Case of Cerro Baena. I groped for my seatbelt, sandwiched with three Chilean students along the bench of the Toyota pickup's cab. I couldn't quite grab the buckle before the truck suddenly took off in the dark, bouncing across a moonlit terrain way too fast. Tuareg erratically and enthusiastically tapped the gas. It was 10 p.m., we hadn't eaten dinner yet, and I had no idea where we were going. It was our last night in the Atacama. All the geologic, rock-pick-in-hand work was done. The laser cowboys, close to finishing the tail end of B-33, were scanning the perfect little discs of bones stacked in a sequence that comprised the midline bony parts of the tail fluke. They had asked us to bring them back some food. "Baked empanadas," Adam said. "Lots of them, please." Sand-worn and ripe, we divided ourselves into two trucks to caravan to dinner. Caro and others went in one truck the usual way to our standard seaside spot, Punta Referencia. Meanwhile, in Tuareg's truck, everyone was too busy talking to notice that Tuareg improvised a different route. We careened along what could be barely called a path made by mining company trucks across a boulder-strewn landscape. The whole truck rocked side to side as Tuareg rapidly gesticulated over the music blaring from the radio. "Tuareg," I intoned. "Mario," I tried again with his real name. "Where are we going?" I knew that I was the stranger in a strange land, awkwardly wearing the hat of expedition lead. As the truck jostled, Tuareg paused in his story and looked at me in the rearview mirror. "Ah, it is no problem," he declared confidently. "We're going to beat the other truck." Tuareg returned to his story as we rounded a high point in the off-road terrain. I looked out at the moon-dappled waves of the Pacific Ocean in the distance. I could see, framed through my constantly shaking window, the outline of El Morro. It dominated the view for miles, a convenient landmark for sharing our location during fieldwork. It is what geologists call an igneous intrusion, the direct result of bubbles of deep, molten rock that ballooned toward the surface many millions of years ago, just now eroding down. Ultimately, subduction was responsible for El Morro, as it was for the stretch of exposed ancient seafloor where we were documenting 40-some whale skeletons. Although Darwin never wrote about El Morro, he could not have missed it on his way out of the Atacama. I imagine the Beagle tacking against the wind, heading to port in Caldera to collect an errant crew member who would change how we understand life on Earth. I felt like I stood to contribute in a small way to that understanding by solving the biggest riddle of my professional life thus far. What happened at Cerro Baena? It was an unusual opportunity because paleontologists generally have difficulty explaining unique events in the geologic past. Most of the time, we'll never know why any one particular thing happened, why Pachycetus went extinct, or why Basilosaurus has such a long tail. Instead, paleontologists are much more comfortable explaining classes of similar events, such as evolutionary convergence in form, or the relationship between the rise and fall of fossil species with changes in Earth's climate. At the outset, Cerro Baena seemed like an isolated, single event. But on closer inspection, we discovered repetitive features, four whale-bearing bone layers stacked on top of one another, which made us think that there could be a unifying explanation about how the site came to be. In some ways, the riddle of Cerro Baena seemed to have unique facts that begged a general cause. For paleontologists looking to explain any site, the first step is often taken on the well-worn path of geology. In this case, the tan, loose sediments at Cerro Baena reflected a single type of environment, which was most similar to a tidal flat. Each of the four layers containing skeleton after skeleton punctuated the otherwise constant backdrop of this environment. A tidal flat, in other words, was the persistent context for each one of the events that led to the bone layers. A tidal flat might not be an unusual place for a seal or a four-limbed aquatic sloth, but is certainly not where any whale, let alone dozens, would show up alive. Judging from the thickness of rock at the site and using an estimate for sediment accumulation in modern tidal flats, we calculated that the rocks encompassed a period of time roughly between 10,000 and 16,000 years. Though it's a range longer than the entire span of human civilization, it's a brief blip for a geologist. We didn't have any rocks that would yield precise radiometric dates, but the species of fossil sharks, based on a few isolated teeth, and aquatic sloths we found at Cerro Baena were also known from rock units in Peru that were better dated. Using that correlation, we applied those dates to Cerro Baena. Our best guess was that Cerro Baena was deposited over a 10,000 to 16,000 year window, sometime between 9 million and 7 million years ago, during the late Miocene. The large fossil baleen whales were the obvious stars of the site, being the largest and most complete skeletons at every bone-bearing level. All of the skeletons represented extinct species of rorquals, the gulp-feeding large whales with iconic living relatives, such as humpback and blue whales. There's also a range of growth stages at the site, from yearlings to adults. Besides the extinct rorquals, there was a panoply of other creatures preserved at the site, including other marine mammals, something that gave not only a solid snapshot into the Humboldt Current during the Miocene, but also a crucially important clue as to the origin of Cerro Baena. The Miocene lasted from about 23 million to 5 million years ago, a span that includes a fair amount of whale evolutionary history. Many of the continents were in their current configuration, although some ocean basins and portals between them existed where they do not today. North America and South America were cleanly separated, for example, by equatorial waters called the Central American Seaway. For long periods of time during the middle of the Miocene, including the time when the Sharktooth Hill bone bed was deposited, global sea level was higher than it is today, as were temperatures. These factors likely fostered the rich diversity we see in the fossil record of many groups during this time. Whales were at their most diverse, occupying a range of niches and body sizes absent among their descendants today. You can think of the Miocene as a kind of fever dream of the present, drawing on familiar members of today's ecosystems, in similar settings, but with occasional aberrant and nightmarish forms. If you went on a whale watch off the coast of Chile in the late Miocene, during the time of Cerro Baena, you would have seen many whales that looked familiar. Early relatives of today's rorquals and oceanic dolphins certainly plied the water, feeding on the same kind of prey that they do today. From a boat, they might have looked largely the same, maybe different in markings and color patterns, though it's likely they had the countershading coloration common to most ocean-going animals. Light on the bottom, dark from the top, to hide from their prey from both above and below. On closer inspection, the early rorqual relatives were not all that large. There were no blue whale-sized ones, and some of the dolphins may have had extremely long snouts, the way river dolphins do today. But beyond the familiar, there would have also been killer sperm whales and walrus whales. Just yards away from B-33 at Cerro Baena, we collected a dozen banana-shaped teeth belonging to an extinct lineage of sperm whale that had both upper and lower teeth covered in enamel. Today's sperm whales have only lower teeth, these miniature ivory anvils, which mostly consist of dentin and not enamel, seize cephalopods large and small. By contrast, their more toothy extinct relatives in the Miocene may have terrorized and consumed other marine mammals, including other whales. At Cerro Baena, we also discovered tusks and parts of a skull belonging to a dolphin species with the face of a walrus, a foreshortened and downturned muzzle bearing two tusks, though strangely unequal in length. The only other fossils of this bizarre species have been found 1,000 miles to the north in Peru. Walruses today are restricted to the high latitudes of the northern hemisphere, and to date, none of their fossils have been found anywhere other than the northern hemisphere. The fact that a lineage of toothed whale evolved a face and a dentition nearly identical to a living walrus suggests that there was an analogous ecological opportunity off the coast of South America in the past few million years that persisted long enough for selection to generate that solution. Walruses are separated by over 100 million years of evolution from whales. Walrus-faced whales, Odobenacetops is their scientific name, likely fed on the seafloor in the shallows along the coast, in the same seagrasses that extinct aquatic sloths inhabited. Yes, fossil sloths evolved long snouts and thickened ribs and limbs, all hallmark aquatic adaptations convergent with sea cows, and, like walrus whales, they have been found only in South America. There were also penguins and other seabirds in the Miocene, although some were very different from what's around today. Some fossil penguin species had much longer beaks, and one extinct seabird, called Pelagornis, had a 17-foot wingspan and cringe-inducing, jagged, pseudo-teeth on its beak, typical of its now-extinct family of bony-toothed seabirds. As they do today, marine mammals and seabirds in the Miocene made a living feeding on the rich zooplankton of the Miocene Humboldt Current, although tracking their prey items is tricky without much of a fossil record. Krill, for example, have no fossil record, but analyses of clock-like sequences in the DNA of living organisms suggest that they have been around since the Cretaceous, some 100 million to 70 million years ago. It is a fair guess that krill were a part of the ancient Humboldt Current, but that's only an inference based on a similar lineup of predators that we see today. One other group of predators also clearly played an outsized role in the Miocene oceans, bust-length megatoothed sharks. These extinct shark species are known almost entirely from their fist-sized teeth, which are abundant in Miocene rocks the world over. Some species, such as the one commonly called Megalodon, its proper scientific name still a matter of debate among specialists, grew 40 feet long and ate whales, among other marine animals. No shark scavenging marks were found on any skeletons at Cerro Baena. The few shark teeth we did find belonged to an extinct species smaller than Megalodon, but probably washed into the tidal flat or were left by intermittent scavenging episodes at high tides. Some scientists have argued the ecological presence of these large sharks elsewhere prevented baleen whales from evolving the large body sizes we see today. The timing of their extinction, around 3 million years ago, coincides with the rise of extremely large whales, although the true cause of the extinction of these terrifying sharks remains mysterious. We tallied a total of 10 different kinds of large marine animals at Cerro Baena, all creatures at the top of the food chain, including both carnivores and herbivores. It was a peculiar list. Whales of many kinds, multiple seal species, aquatic sloths, and billfishes. And, most amazing to me, our inventory captured all of the unique fossil marine mammal species that have been found only in South America, walrus whales and aquatic sloths, within just a few hundred yards of road cut. That lineup told us an important clue. There was likely some kind of factor that concentrated them all there, in one spot, over the course of at least 4 separate episodes. Knowing the geological stage and the ecological players narrowed the explanations for the origin of Cerro Baena. How was it that both big ocean-going marine carnivores and herbivores ended up feet and yards away from one another, some perfectly preserved, stem to stern, like B-33? How did air-breathing and gilled vertebrates, namely the billfishes, end up in the same site? Last and most important, how could all of these factors line up 4 times in the same place? Instances when different species of cetaceans and other marine mammals washed up together were rare, but they were well documented, especially in the United States. And interestingly, every time a multi-species stranding had a putative explanation, harmful algal blooms were the common and sole culprit. HAB, for short, these single-celled organisms, including different species of diatoms, dinoflagellates, or blue-green algae, have the ability to cause widespread death in marine consumers because the toxins that they produce become concentrated as larger and larger organisms higher up the food chain eat more and more of them. While HABs include a wide range of species and toxins that manifest themselves in a variety of ways, algal blooms, red tides, and the like, they all work the same way. When the single-celled organisms reach sufficiently dense aggregations, a so-called bloom at a local scale, its toxic effects become magnified as bigger and bigger consumers eat more and more poison prey. Ultimately, something microscopic can kill the top players in marine food webs. Whales, other marine mammals, billfishes, and humans too. If the HAB explanation for Cerro Baena was right, it also explained an important feature we had seen in the geology of the site. Orange halos throughout each bone-bearing layer, which our team's sedimentologist attributed to iron staining from algal mats. While it would be difficult to determine if the organisms that caused these formations were the algae of death, it was clear that they fixed iron that was mobile in the environment. Iron is extremely important where HABs are concerned. In the modern world, iron supercharges their potency, increasing the extent and duration of a bloom. Science works by eliminating bad explanations until we're left with the simplest argument or the fewest steps, with the broadest explanatory power. No other explanation for the peculiarities of Cerro Baena held up to scrutiny. It wasn't a group whale fall, far too shallow. If you wanted to be fanciful, you might think that an earthquake or a tsunami might somehow send a raft of carcasses into a tidal flat. Not only are there no modern examples to support this idea, but also the geology of the site showed no such high-energy, catastrophic sedimentary structures. And most important, any death mechanism would have needed to have happened in more or less the exact same way and same place 4 times. Where other explanations failed, or only explained a particular set of observations, HABs could explain the totality of what we knew about Cerro Baena. As best I can tell, the story of what happened at Cerro Baena goes something like this. Sometime in the late Miocene, Between 9 million and 7 million years ago, a vast, shallow tidal flat opened to the South Pacific Ocean, perhaps slightly corralled by a small chain of rocky islands and surrounded by a hyper-arid desert inland. Offshore, now extinct species of whales, bizarre dolphins with walrus faces, ancient seals,